Hello, everybody. Thank you very much for joining me for this episode of Last Born in the Wilderness. I am your host, Patrick Farnsworth. If you want to learn more about the podcast, you can go to the website lastborninthewilderness.com. If you want to support this podcast, the first thing you can do is subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. And if you listen to this on Apple Podcasts, please consider leaving a review. If you would like to really sustain this work through financial contributions, the first way you can do that is through a one-time donation, either through PayPal or Venmo. You can go to paypal.me/lastbornpodcast, or you can find me on Venmo at lastbornpodcast. If you'd like to sustain this work regularly, monthly, or yearly, you can do that through Patreon. Go to patreon.com/lastbornin the wilderness. And that is it, everybody. Thank you so much. Enjoy the episode. In this interview, I speak with Lily K. Ross. Lily is a sexual violence researcher and arts and gender editor at Symposia, and she joins me to discuss her research and insights into the dark underbelly of psychedelic therapy, a subject expertly explored in Power Trip, a New York Magazine investigative podcast series that she is the co-creator and producer of. To give some background on Lily, Lily has been taking a feminist approach to theorizing ethics in psychedelic spaces since 2009, especially with regard to sexual misconduct, abuses of power, charlatans, and the dominance of traditional gender norms in psychedelic spaces. Her PhD research looks into how neoliberal discourses burden victim survivors of sexual violence with the directive to individually overcome social problems and the trouble with post-traumatic growth. Her other projects advance best practice and evidence-based policies and responses to sexual harm. She is a feminist writer, educator, and violence prevention facilitator. After a five-year hiatus from psychedelics, she is happy to be home. As psychedelics become less stigmatized in the West, particularly the United States and other Western societies, and popularized as tools for trauma therapy and vehicles for spiritual enlightenment, Lily K. Ross has been documenting something far more complex and nefarious under the surface of the optimistic image of the psychedelic renaissance: sexual misconduct, abuse, ethical malfeasance. As she documents in Power Trip, there are numerous documented cases of so-called shamans and psychedelic guides taking advantage of their clients, violating bodily autonomy, and then gaslighting victims into accepting abuse as part of the healing journey. This issue has been raised numerous times over the years, and Lily has observed and personally experienced what happens when these subjects are presented to the psychedelic community: a combination of victim blaming, obfuscation, and silence. The kind of questions that are asked in this interview are: if psychedelics are to be ethically applied in therapy and therapeutic environments, what protocols must be implemented to avoid these abuses from occurring? So this is what we discussed in this interview. I was able to talk to Lily in between part one and part two of this podcast series, Power Trip. Part two will be released, I think, a day or so after the release of this interview with Lily. So I was able to speak to her at a really good time in this little lag between these two parts. So I'd really ask, if people want to learn more about Lily's work, the first place to go is to symposia.com. A lot of her work is found there, as well as everything you need to know about Symposia as a nonprofit organization that is discussing a lot of these really important subjects around the psychedelic renaissance, providing a critical lens to what is really going on here with this movement. And if you want to, of course, subscribe to Power Trip, you can listen to that, subscribe to that anywhere you listen to podcasts. Really just want to thank Lily for her incredible work and for what the folks at Symposia do with their work as well. And that is it, everybody. Thank you so much for your attention. Here's my interview with Lily K. Ross. Lily, it's really good to have you on the podcast. Thanks for carving out some time for me.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, and as I said before we started recording, I've become familiar with Symposia, which you are a member of, a part of. My first interview with Brian Pace, and then the next one with David Nichols, and then I think when actually I did speak to David, he's like, we're cooking up something really good. You know, we'll see when this comes out, but it's going to be really, really a big deal. And he was very excited for it. And just over the past couple months or more, there's been this really excellent series that you have been a part of. David has been a part of in his way as well. But really, you're kind of the central, well, one of the central individuals in this podcast series from New York Magazine, cover story. And I believe that the title of the series, I guess, is Power Trip, right?
That's right.
Yeah. Yeah. And I guess I'll just ask about the series. I mean, there's been 5 episodes released so far. So from my understanding, there's a second part, like some more episodes that are being prepared right now. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah. The next episodes will start airing on March 1st.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
It's coming up.
Y'all will have a chance to hear much more of Dave in those episodes as well.
Good. Yeah. Yeah. Good. Well, I mean, you and the host, Io, are digging into something that, I'll just say this. I've said this before many times on the podcast, but there was like an original kind of naivete that I had about psychedelics, this like starry-eyed, like, this is an amazing tool, and it's like transporting me to this other, and I was like this mind expansion thing, and if everybody could take, you know, psilocybin mushrooms or something, then the world would be better. You know, this really naive, grandiose thing, and through subsequent exposure to different really excellent writers and symposia in particular, you know, I really have a much more nuanced view of what is actually going on in psychedelic spaces and in the so-called psychedelic renaissance that is occurring right now. And then, of course, I was exposed to your work and the experiences that you have shared through this podcast series, Power Trip. And, you know, you're not the first person that I've heard of that has been experienced forms of abuse or manipulation and other very coercive experiences in those spaces. It seems to be a pervasive thing. And you, using your personal experiences as well as your ability as a journalist, as a researcher, and through this podcast series, you're exposing something that I think really needs to be discussed within not only psychedelia, but our society at large, if we're going to move towards decriminalizing and making psychedelics a therapeutic tool. So that little introduction there, I just want to ask, like, with everything that you've done so far with the podcast series Power Trip, what has the response been in general to the series up to this point?
Yeah, it's a good question. And my knowledge of the response is fairly limited to just like what I see in my lane. So I think what stood out to me is that a number of people have reached out requesting engagement of like, I have a story, I have information. Like, a lot of the people who I've had contact with have been really supportive of the work and appreciative of the work. You know, we've had some people commenting to say, hey, this is causing me to, like, you know, think differently about experiences that didn't feel right, but that I didn't fully understand or hadn't really unpacked. So there's like an analytic value. And then there's people that are saying, like, I'm stepping away from the psychedelic therapy space. I'm not pursuing this anymore for my career because, like, this, what I'm seeing is really makes me uncomfortable. Or so most of the responses I've seen have been really positive. I see a bit of an appetite for more robust and rigorous conversations about ethics with regard to like psychedelic practice. And I appreciate seeing that. And I also feel like there's a psychedelic ethics needs to be its own discipline. Like, there's no one expert on it. It should be a space of debate and discussion and ongoing dialogue. And so I'm reticent to like get too involved in that, in just like one-on-one conversations, because I think that is by default a conversation that needs to be happening at the community level with multiple stakeholders. And yet where I see some spaces for the psychedelic ethics conversation, there's a lot of indications that people don't actually have the skill set or the capacity to have those conversations in productive ways and in ways that don't exclude some of the people that like have experiences with unethical behavior. So that's all to say that it's, you know, it's quite mixed. I know there's some people that, you know, use the word sensational or tabloid fodder.
Tabloid fodder?
Yeah. Really? Yeah. We've gotten tabloid fodder. We've gotten a lot of sensational. I mean, you know, teach yeah. their own. I will say from a creative perspective, the teams put a lot of effort into trying to actually dial back, you know, the music and the aesthetic choices, to have lots of pauses in space, to have music that has a searching quality rather than like a hitting you over the head with the suspense quality, or, you know, so it's an interesting medium to be offering up a journalistic investigation, because there is like a storytelling component that comes into play. So anyway, it's a long-winded way of saying it's mixed, but by and large, I'm very hopeful, just in light of how many people are writing into Symposia to say that they feel emboldened to talk about what happened to them, whether it's to us or to other people in their lives. Like, that to me is just really fills my heart.
Yeah. Well, I guess I want to talk about the nature of... Actually, there's a lot of directions I want to go in with this. It's hard to figure out which one to go in, because what you said there is like people reaching out to Symposia, out to you, to say, hey, like, I had this experience or series of experiences, I'm sure, that maybe on further reflection were not consensual. Things happened to me, or there was something about the experience, whether it was explicit or not, that just didn't feel safe. And maybe I tucked it away, you know, and that's some, a lot of times that's how traumatic experiences work. But I think with psychedelics in particular, when you're throwing in this thing as powerful as a psychedelic, the dynamic between a guide or therapist or shaman or whatever they call themselves.
Charlatan.
That's a good one too. They don't call themselves that typically, but that's what they may be, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And then the person that is, I guess, what would you call them? The person that's undergoing the so-called treatment or the experience with a psychedelic. There's a power imbalance there, to say the very least. Even more so, I would say, than under traditional therapeutic setting, a traditional therapeutic environment. Because at least under, when I say traditional, I mean people are typically pretty sober in those environments. So certainly there's unethical stuff that happens between a so-called guide or therapist and a person, the client. But when you have a psychedelic thrown in there, it's reaches a completely different level. And so I really wanted to ask about that, because people that are in those experience, that have those experiences, they may not be able to, this is nothing against them at all. It's just that there may not be a language or a framework to identify when something coercive has happened, something abusive has happened. So if you could talk about those kind of dynamics a little bit, open the space up for you to just sort of get into that.
Yeah, I appreciate the way that you're framing the concept and the question. I think that you're right. Like, there are power differences endemic to therapeutic relationships, medical relationships. There's a few unique aspects of the psychedelic experience itself that lend the whole thing to a different level of vulnerability. So first of all, especially in the post-pollen context, there's a big flashing billboard that says, "Come ye most vulnerable. If you've tried everything, you might want to try this next."
So this is the Michael Pollan, very famous author who wrote a book about psychedelics.
Right. That's right. That's right. Okay. So the Pollan effect would refer to, like, after his book How to Change Your Mind came out, a lot of people that were not interested in psychedelics suddenly were interested in psychedelics. And because there's such an emphasis on the discourse of medicalization, there's a lot of people who have tried different kinds of, you know, mental health treatments or things to alleviate their suffering, and it hasn't worked. So then they're seeking out psychedelics. And because there hasn't been medical approval, the place, one of the main places they can look, and a place that's being marketed very, in some ways discreetly, but in a lot of ways overtly, is the psychedelic underground. Mm-hmm. So people are being pushed into a black market therapeutic economy, They're vulnerable to begin with. They come into that space. There's no criteria or standards for training. There's no oversight. There's no licensing board. Many people who practice in that way have opted not to be licensed. Others have opted to be licensed. And then if there's allegations against them, they surrender their license, which in a few cases historically has put a stay on further criminal investigation because, you know, they give up their medical license or their therapeutic license, and that's kind of enough for the authorities. So different approaches for different types of people. But once people come into that space, there's the suggestibility enhancing quality of the psychedelic experience. You enter into a space with somebody who is telling you, I know what's going to heal you. You're high on a suggestibility enhancing drug. Maybe you're desperate for relief and they're telling you, oh, if you do the things I say, or you let me do the things to you that I feel need to be done, you know, what the passive voice, the sense of what is needed in this, in this container of the psychedelic journey. That's going to produce resolution or relief or healing. And so it primes people to, you know, for coercion, ultimately, for coercion and manipulation, and to be encouraged into situations that may not actually be in their self-interest. And so it's pretty tricky and dicey. And then there's the layer of, like, whether it's a classic psychedelic of a tryptamine or phenethylamines, especially the sort of, like, you know, mescaline and some of the alphabetamines, there's, like, the boundary dissolution and sense of interconnection with all things. With MDMA, it's the very acute sense of, like, trusting people and inhibited fear response and feeling connected and close. So there are different kinds of boundary dissolution, but they're both types of boundary dissolution. And so if a person is in a state where, you know, there's not really a sense of boundaries, there's hypersuggestibility, and this dynamic that happens where the guide, like, the guide seems like God. If you're in a place where everything is God and you are God and God is God, and, you know, what, you know, the places people can go to in high dose psychedelics, you know, there's a kind of projection that can happen onto the guide or therapist as the person who's given you this experience and is holding the container for you. And from what I've seen, like, there's indications that a lot of quote unquote guides get off on that.
Sure.
You know, that's kind of what they're there for. That's like a source of narcissistic supply for them if they happen to be more narcissistic in their personality type, or it's just a thing that feels really good. And they may not have this many, I think, don't have the skills to recognize, oh, that person is high on a drug that makes everything God. And how do I use my skills as a practitioner to redirect that and not take that personally, because it's tempting to take it personally. So I think, just to summarize, that there's a lot about the psychedelic experience. There's a lot of pitfalls for the guides. I think being the person who administers drugs to people actually gets to people's heads. And I don't think people have thought about that very much.
Yeah. I mean, I think the level of responsibility that a guide has, that the kind of skills that you would need to have and develop to be able to perform that ethically. There's, like, to me, it seems that there's literally no protocols around this. Like, people are kind of just make this shit up, and people might have a big reputation. They might be well known within the psychedelic community or world, and that's enough. It's like, I've heard of this person, I've heard good things about them, I'm going to trust them, and I'm basically like a piece of a putty in their hands. And that's, I don't know, it's like wild to me, because even though there can be some serious issues with, you know, modern psychiatry or psychotherapy or any of these things that we can talk about, there seems to be at least certain protocols in place, and psychedelics don't seem to have that right now. So,
they don't have it right now. And in fact, I would say, as sort of a participant observer in the psychedelic underground, there's a real reticence to have formalization, protocols, oversight. People are not, a lot of people who gravitate towards practicing an illegal form of therapy to begin with are not the people that are really excited about setting professional norms and adhering to them.
Isn't there a bit of a contradiction, though? Because it feels like this whole psychedelic renaissance that is happening is about making psychedelics not only to remove a taboo or stigma on psychedelic use in society at large, in Western societies, but to, you know, move to a path of decriminalizing it, to make it so it's a therapy that can be used. And that seems like if you're going to go down that path, it would mean that there would be some sort of guidelines, ethical guidelines set in place around this kind of thing. So it's an interesting, seems to me to be a contradiction.
Well, sort of. I guess I see a little bit differently. Rick yeah. Doblin has talked about medicalization as a Trojan horse for legalization. And yet, as the billionaires and millionaires get involved with their different corporadelic firms and start to research novel chemicals and new interventions and new routes of administration that they can monetize, there is something we at Symposia talk about is like prohibition light, because more and more the conversation is not about decriminalization. It's about having legal sanctioned medical use, and everything else is still illegal and criminalized. And I think that presents a whole set of issues, because the underground practitioners will continue to practice in the underground. Like, that's not going anywhere. Right. And I also think that, like, even in a, if we were to take the situation right now as it's unfolding and imagine a context of like a post-prohibition world of decriminalization, maybe coexisting with medicalization, I think there's an issue around psychedelic ethics as a grossly underdeveloped discipline. You know, I mean, if you look at just in the broadest sense, you know, you pick up an academic paper and any given paragraph, you know, or like in an opening, it might be, you know, so-and-so in such and such year said this, but then this other person came along and said this other thing, and like, wow, was that a shakeup to the field? And then this other person came along and tried to sort of synthesize them, and then this person subverted it with the, there's a history of people who are trying to think through an issue in conversation with each other, presenting different ideas and debating those ideas. And it's like, I remember I went to, I think it was the Psychedelic Sciences 2013 conference in Oakland, California. And I got so excited because Julie Holland was going to be giving this talk on psychedelic ethics. And I was like, oh, thank God. I'm so excited. Like, this is a conversation I think is so important. And I went to the talk, and it was like every three slides was like a picture of like a leaf or like some dirt. And, you know, so she spaced up her like information slides with like, now let's look at a tree. And then she got to the very end, and her conclusion was that psychedelic research is ethical, that like it's the ethical thing to do because of the veterans and because of the people who are suffering and because of the... And I was so disappointed. I was like, this is it? This is what you have to say for psychedelic ethics, is that psychedelic research is ethical? Like, there are, I was in my mid-20s, and I had been to the Amazon, and I had had negative experiences, and I had seen a lot of people acting in ways that seemed unethical and poorly considered and problematic. And I was like, there is such an important conversation to be had here, and it's not happening. How is this not happening? This is the psychedelic ethics talk? This is what y'all got? And I have to say, like, the field hasn't come much further. There was an article that came out in 2020 or 2021 by Smith and Sisti. And one of the points they – and, like, no shade on them for what they, you know, wrote about it. They wrote like three paragraphs about touch in psychedelic sessions. There's not many citations there because there's nobody to really cite. And it's like this really cursory kind of brief consideration of this like massively complicated and complex topic that like me and some of my colleagues could write reams about. Mm-hmm. And here it is just getting this three paragraph treatment. And like, there's no other literature in the field to like really point to as far as what's ethical and what's acceptable and what are the norms. So I think one of my beliefs at the moment is like, we need rigorous psychedelic science. We need rigorous debate. We need really in-depth consideration of some of the intricacies and identification of problems and pitfalls clinically and in our research methodologies, in order to, you know, have any hope of finding a sound path forward.
Yeah. Well, because I was listening to that podcast series, Power Trip, and I don't know if it's in there. I believe it is. When you first started to speak out about your personal experiences and really criticizing these spaces and what happens in them. I don't know. I just want to ask about this because this is something that's, I'm sorry, there's so many people who experience, you know, sexual assault, they experience this a lot, which is, you know, it's called victim blaming. I guess I'll ask you if you could talk about the ways in which the psychedelic community has attempted to do just that.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, my PhD was very focused on understanding victim blame around sexual violence in the context of neoliberal capitalism. So I can speak to this for a long time. And if I'm rambling, just, you know, cut in.
No, please. Go for it.
But I think there's a couple of things I would say that come to bear on this. One, the sort of lowest hanging fruit would be this concept called just world theory. It's basically the idea that bad things happen to bad people and good things happen to good people. Mm. And it has a function psychologically because I think a lot of the emotional experience that I had when encountering victim blame, which was frequent and everywhere, was this feeling like people were trying to make it clear that what happened to me would never happen to them because they're not that kind of person that would have that kind of experience. Mm. Right. And so that was like, there was a lot of sting to that. That was pretty pervasive and kind of pretty basic. There were some much more, I think, in some ways like interesting, things that were also going on, which is like in the context of late capitalism and neoliberal capitalism, like it's not just an economic system, it's also an ideology, and it's an ideology that promotes personal responsibility. And you combine that with like the women's liberation movement, which really emphasized women's sexual liberation, which you can kind of look at that and be like, who did that really benefit? Because it certainly posed some benefits for men as well as women. Mm-hmm. But there's this idea that goes along with that, that women have sexual agency and that that sexual agency both allows for them to pursue the sex they want, but also to deny the sex that they don't. So it's therefore woman's responsibility to assert her boundaries and her agency by saying no and being clear about the sex that she doesn't want. And the baseline is that it's not that simple. You know, the research that we have about, you know, men's willingness to engage in sexually coercive behavior and the intentionality or some of the strategies that coercive men will use in order to engage in acts of sexual assault and sexual violence, are pretty mind-blowing and confronting. You know, I think it's a lot easier to in our society to focus on blaming the victim rather than acknowledging that, like, oh, like, gosh, you know, some people are really, they're willing to disregard what other people's wants are and their bodily autonomy in pursuit of getting off. Like, that's mm-hmm. a dark thing to have to grapple with. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot going on. And I think one of the things that was very unique to the psychedelic community, or at least I started seeing it sort of that way, but then in the context of this kind of neoliberal understanding, my view really expanded. And that is the idea of post-traumatic growth. So not only are we supposed to avoid being a victim, because the victim label has been recast in the last couple of decades, it really, instead of meaning, like, victim really should connote that something bad, like victimizing, happened to a person. Mm-hmm. And instead we talk about victims as like a characterological feature, as if like a person with a victim mentality, like that victimhood is inherent to the person who's been harmed, not a function of like events and experiences that they had that were out of their control. Mm-hmm. And so this idea of post-traumatic growth comes in because there's this additional expectation that if one does experience victimization, which, let's be real, sexual harm is a form of victimization that is like widely tolerated in our culture. It's a social and cultural problem, yeah. And it's pervasive. But this post-traumatic growth thing then says, okay, now it's your job as an individual to find benefit in adversity and grow yourself through the traumatic experience, as though like, okay, so you've been traumatized, so now there's an expectation for self-improvement and a healing journey to become a survivor, to become a non-victim in the world. So I think that comes to bear in psychedelic spaces. I mean, I wrote a whole section of my thesis on the journey metaphor, and I actually wasn't thinking about psychedelics. It's really prevalent in the qualitative literature and the way victims and victim survivors talk about their post-victimization experience is this journey away from victimhood and towards survivorship. And then I came back to the psychedelic community and was like, oh my God, this language of the journey is freaking everywhere.
Yeah.
And I don't just mean like the journey session. I mean like the wider shamanic healing journey that is, you know, life or whatever. Anyway, I hope I'm making some sense, but I think the baseline is just that, you know, there's a lot of emphasis in psychedelic spaces on individual healing to transform the world. And a lot of, I think, the trauma that people, especially women and non-binary folks and queer folks, are trying to heal in psychedelic spaces, and men, there's plenty of male victims of sexual harm. It is sexual harm. It is sexual trauma. And it bothers me that it's that dealing with the consequences of this profoundly social problem is foisted onto the shoulders of the individuals who have suffered.
Yeah.
End of rant.
No, yeah. And there was one element to it that really stuck out to me in Power Trip, which was people coming to you or to other victims and saying, if this is talked about too openly, then this will get in the way of our long-term goal of, you know, destigmatizing psychedelics. Like, if people start associating psychedelics again with bad things happening to people, then we won't get it legalized, we won't get it decriminalized, and so on.
Yep. And it's really unfortunate, because I think if we learn anything from some of the university scandals and the Harvey Weinstein scandal and like the Me Too movement, the thing that makes it a scandal isn't even the fact that sexual violence happened. It's the cover-up. And I think that's maybe, that may be the sort of direction that things are moving in the psychedelic space, as more people come forward with stories and more accounts of atrocious responses to victims. I've spent a bit of time in my career looking at institutional responses to sexual harm and disclosures, like some of the research about how to respond to disclosures. And, you know, there's a whole field of specialists in sexual violence prevention and developing institutional responses and policies and training people in workplaces to, you know, be more prepared to respond to reports or allegations of sexual harm. There's, I've spent a lot of time with one of my colleagues, Dr. Kayla Stewart, really thinking about what some of those procedures in workplaces could look like. And by no means are we the only ones. You know, we're drawing on, you know, existing work and best practice research in those spaces. And I think, you know, within psychedelics, like, there's no need to reinvent the wheel. I was in a talk a couple of years ago, and somebody in the audience was saying, oh, we need to be so gentle with ourselves. You know, this, we're new to kind of figuring this sexual harm stuff out. And, you know, it's really difficult. And I told them, like, with all due respect, like, gentleness for sure. And also, there is a whole body of work in feminist sexual violence research that dates back decades that we could be learning so much from. You know, I strongly discourage psychedelic people from trying to reinvent the wheel or think that there's something totally, you know, unique or superior about this community that somehow it need not learn from some of the great thinkers that have come before and really charted out some very useful ways of thinking about these issues and some very practical ways of dealing with them. So, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Do you think that in psychedelic spaces, psychedelic organizations, and so on, that there is a willful or just a complete ignorance surrounding? Because we talk about feminist studies, you know, there is I would say a more left wing component to that, and often an anti-capitalist angle to that. I don't know how else to say it, and it's like these people that are psychedelic, it feels to me like they have this woo-woo, new-agey kind of attitude. Like, we're beyond politics and we don't want to be on this left versus right type of thing. You know, I hear a lot of that. So they may be just not in a position, or willingly or not, to engage with really deep critical studies that do have a political ideology. Do you think that that's the case, that they're just like not familiarizing themselves with these studies because it just doesn't feel like, oh, that doesn't belong here in something as spiritual and open as a psychedelic experience? Or like, what is people's, I guess, general attitude when you bring that up to them? Like, there are these like robust bodies of study here that we can turn to for this. What is the response to that?
You know, I made the point in one talk, but I haven't been around the space enough to really know people's reaction to it beyond that. You know, I left the space. You know, you talk about this idea of, you know, protecting the movement, which is no different from when there's a sexual harm case in universities and they say, oh, we take this matter very seriously, but you look under the hood and the response has been just a complete mess at the expense of the victim, and the perpetrator still graduates on time with no real hangups to their studies or whatever the case study may be. What I have seen in many different institutional settings is a reputation management, and at the expense of people. It's the reputation of the institution. And I think that the psychedelic movement in the broadest sense is enacting the exact same thing that we would see in formal institutional settings. As far as like, you know, what motivates people, I think it's hard to know, really. I ask right. myself this question a lot in light of some of the investigations we've been carrying out that you'll learn more about in part two. Is this sloppiness? Is this malfeasance? Is this ignorance? Is this like, I've been thinking a lot about this like concept of like malicious incompetence, which I'm sure there's like a better word for. Mm-hmm. Do people care? Like, I'm not convinced that some of the, I think there's something to be said for institutional reputation management. I also think there's a lot to be said for the lengths that people will go to try to either obtain or retain power. Mm. And I think that unfortunately really has to bear here. I mean, what are people protecting? Who are people protecting? Because like when I think about, like, I left the psychedelic space years ago. I had no intentions of coming back. I was on a trajectory to, like, you know, go work in nonprofit and government spaces and, like, you know, go do really different stuff. And I just sort of got, like, tractor beamed back in, you know, a couple of years ago. And I think about how many people the space has lost. And I think about how many people with such wonderful contributions they could have made to psychedelic research or practice who are just off doing other things now, or in some cases debilitated and not able to pursue those other things because of the extent of the harm that they've suffered. I mean, when I think about the time suck, you know, how many people, especially women and non-binary and queer folks, who have lost such valuable time and vital energy to having to deal with the consequences, not just of this shitty behavior, but of the secondary victimization that has happened in so many instances. Like, that's what breaks my heart. You know, yeah. Like the suffering and the lost potential.
Yeah.
There's a lot more than that that breaks my heart. That's not the only thing that breaks my heart.
Of course.
But, you know, It's a difficult situation, and
I guess, you know, I feel like the question I asked before you said all that was seemingly naive, because it's like, why do these people do what they do? And at a certain point, you're just like, well, who gives a shit? You know, the abuse is happening. It needs to be addressed. And if people can't handle that, then that's on them. And we just have to do it anyway, because that's the right thing to do. I mean, what else do you do in that situation? Yeah,
that's right. You know, it's like that thing in like the most, I don't know, mundane or relatable situation. Like, you know, if you've got a friend and they're in a relationship and their partner's acting like a bit of a jerk, and it's that like, oh, but I don't think they mean it. Or like, I don't, you know, sometimes I've said to friends like, well, it sounds really manipulative. And they said, but they don't do it on purpose. And it's like, it doesn't matter if they do it on purpose. If they're doing it on purpose, they're a fucking psychopath. Like, odds are it's not on purpose, but it's still manipulative. Yeah. I think the same theory kind of applies, whether it's like to the cover-ups and the institutions or the people who enable and turn a blind eye, or the people who are engaged in the harmful behavior themselves. Like, I don't really care what's motivating some of the people that we talked about in part one. Like, I have some kind of an interest in it. I have some theories. I have a kind of a sense of what I think might be going on. But at the same time, it's like, what I care about is the actions that they're taking and the community that's enabling them and the consequences that that has for the people that they're doing it to.
Yeah. Yeah, of course. Is there, in line with this type of work that you're doing, is there, because it's one thing to expose it and to document it and report on it and make it a very public thing. Are there support networks or any sort of like I wonder, like, you know, I don't know if it's a unique type of trauma to undergo a psychedelic experience and have those experiences to experience trauma through that environment. But I mean, I imagine that there's a whole group of people. I mean, from my understanding of listening to Power Trip, is like you're talking to a whole group of different people, and they seem sometimes to be fairly isolated from one another. Like, they don't necessarily know each other or know what to do with what happened to them. And then it can allow them to interpret it. And really, yeah, they may not know how to interpret what happened to them. Yeah. So I guess, is there anything out there for people who have experienced this type of thing?
It's a really good question. The number one piece of advice I give people is look into your local feminist rape crisis or domestic violence resources and organizations. There's RAIN. There's if you go to, I think, symposia.com/resources, there's like a resource page with a bunch of different organizations. There's like a really cool one that will like connect you with like a social worker that can direct you to services in your area. And the thing is, like, I direct people to mainstream services largely because in my experience and in my research, you know, sexual harm and violation is what it is, regardless of the context. And there are context-specific factors that a sexual violence expert or therapist can upskill in pretty quickly. To me, that feminist analysis is a lot more important as a baseline than an understanding of psychedelics. Mm-hmm. So that's one of the main things that I encourage people to do. I mean, the other thing is, you know, as, you know, Will Hall's article has come out and Power Trip has come out, you know, more people are talking about their experiences and searching out those nooks and crannies of their communities where they can speak freely and try to make sense of things. I think it was Linda Alcoff who wrote in the last couple of years about how, you know, sexual harm, and I'm paraphrasing here, but sexual harm is something that over a period of time, you know, victims and survivors are sort of unpacking and interpreting and making sense of in different ways at different times in relationship to other people. That sense making happens in relationships. And so I think I think people have been very isolated in trying to deal with the consequences of these harmful behaviors. And my hope is that more people will find each other and will find people who, you know, I think it's really important when you are talking to a person who is saying, I've been hurt, to center their needs and their experience. You know, if you or listeners find themselves fielding a disclosure, you know, make it about what the other person needs. Don't jump in and threaten to go after the perpetrator, and don't make it about you, and don't say, well, we have to go to the police, or we have to report it, or you have to do this. It's like, listen, ask them what they need, ask them what would be helpful, like in the most basic way. You know, and I think the more people that are equipped to listen and learn, I think something that has underpinned my approach and David's approach to Power Trip is the radical idea that people who have been harmed have knowledge that counts. What they have to say matters. So if members of communities are more willing to like lend an ear, lend a shoulder, listen, learn, go along for the ride, I think there's hope there, because really, like, finding other people who have similar experiences, working through it together, there's a lot to be said for solidarity and mutual support and connecting to others. And I think there's a lot of people that are not people I would want to seek comfort and engagement from. So I think that's the other thing too, is like, you know, my hope is that more and more victims and survivors will be able to find spaces where they feel supported and understood and able to wrestle and tussle and work through the storm that may be inside them without other people needing to manage their own difficult emotions about it. Because that's a thing. Like, it's difficult to hear disclosures. So anyway, another rant.
Yeah. Well, no, that's great. I want you to rant. When you were talking about people grappling with their experiences, and they do that often in relationship, right? Whatever that relationship is, it's often like communicating and speaking to someone about it. I was just thinking, like, if the psychedelic community, using quotations around community, is actually in a community, you are going to listen to everybody that is a part of that community. You're going to listen to those that have experienced harm and acknowledge that and integrate that into the community. And how, you know, how can we minimize these types of things from happening? How can we make it go away so that it doesn't happen? Not to ignore it, not to put it to the periphery and pretend it's not happening, but to, like, this is happening and we have to develop spaces that are safer. I mean, it's just, that's what community, like, really is. It's not this neoliberal bullshit that we hear about community all the time. It's like when you go to work and they say it's a family, you know, we're all family, and you're like, no, it's not actually. Or if it is a family, it's a fucking abusive one, you know.
Or a cult.
Or a cult. Exactly. Right. Okay. Well, I have maybe one more question, which is, like, really about your attitude towards psychedelics in general, which is just to say, like, you're obviously tackling something that has been underreported or has not been highlighted nearly enough, which is the forms of abuse that exist within psychedelic spaces. But I guess I just want to get a general sense of, and you talk about this in Power Trip, but I think it's important for people to hear this that are listening to this interview. You know, what do you think about psychedelics in general as far as being used as a form of spiritual experiences or therapy? You know, obviously the big thing now is that it can help alleviate trauma, work with PTSD, addiction, things like this. Do you think there's merit to those things, or do you, I guess, what is your general attitude around how it's being presented to the public right now?
Well, there's a lot about that that I can't answer just yet. And I can say tune in to Power Trip Part 2, which comes out on March 1st, for a little more insight on what I've come to learn about those questions. Okay. But what I can say is just say no, kids. No. No, what I can say is I don't think that there is good evidence for prohibition or criminalization. Mm-hmm. I think... you know, looking to some of the models in other countries, there's actually a lot to suggest that decriminalization and providing safe access to people makes for safer environments and better education. And so, you know, I want to live in a world where people can take the drugs they want to take, psychedelics or whatever, in the environments of their choosing. And for those environments to be, you know, as safe as can be. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and I think there's lots of, like, what is even the notion of a legitimate drug use? You know, like, if we want to mm-hmm. borrow that term, it's like, well, it's all legitimate. You know, I have a friend, Dr. Simon Clay, who writes a bit about, you know, wild self-care and the ways in which, you know, gay men cope with some of the some of their struggles and some of the drug use that can go along with that, and frames that as a form of self-care, whereas you know, medical institutions have previously categorized it as forms of self-harm. And asking those questions about what are people getting out of this drug use, whether it's, you know, meth or GHB or MDMA or LSD or whatever it is. So, you know, I mean, that's the world in a very simplified, brief nutshell that I would like to live in.
Right. Well, I asked that question just because I think often this can be framed in a very dualistic or binary way, which is like, if psychedelics can produce have these harmful environments attached to them, then we should keep them, you know, criminalized and make sure that people don't have access to them. But obviously that hasn't worked. It's only pushed it underground and has not made it work either. So it's not a either or. It's like, we should have them available for people that want to take them. They shouldn't be criminalized for using them, but we just need to really really interrogate some of these claims that are being made about them and how they're being used and how it's affecting people.
Totally. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I do hope that people will have a listen to part two, because, you know, some of the questions about some of the research and some of the some of what's been going on in the above ground is something we're really trying to focus on and unpack and understand. And there's a lot more complexity there than I ever, ever would have imagined before I set out on this investigation. It was never something we thought we would be looking at in the way that we've come to look at it. So, you know, come along on the shamanic healing journey of discovery with us. Oh God.
Yeah, it is very corny, but people take it very seriously. So, well, I just want to say, you know, I really have, I think I kind of put off listening to the Power Trip series just because it's such a heavy subject. But I think particularly those that are very interested in psychedelics and drugs should really give it a listen and understand. And it's not just about that either. It's about understanding how power works, how victims are blamed for the experiences they've had. And that is something a lot of people, regardless of whether they've had psychedelics or not, can relate with. And I think needs to be more widely understood how those dynamics play out institutionally and individually as well.
Yeah. Yeah, I appreciate that a lot. And I think too, is just something that I want to be sure to at least name is the concept that Dave has given a name, which is psychedelic authoritarianism, the idea that the practitioner knows what's best and the manifestations that can have in practice. So I really appreciate you taking the time to listen. And it's been a really wonderful experience to get to do this work and to, you know, get to bring people into the conversation. And I really appreciate how thoughtful your questions have been. Thank you very much for that.
Of course. I try my best. So I'll say you have part two. Can I ask, do you know how many more episodes there will be? Is this like the end of the series, the part two, or?
Yeah. So New York Magazine's cover story is like the umbrella show of, you know, different investigative series. And then this series for season one is Power Trip. And so part one was 5 episodes that dropped late last year. And then part two is slated to be 4 episodes that will drop the first 4 Tuesdays of March.
Okay.
Yeah. Great. And you can find it on Spotify or Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts. And for those who would like to read a transcript rather than listen to the material, because listening can be a bit more confronting, you can check that out on New York Magazine's The Cut website.
Yeah, I found that webpage, and it was very helpful. I think podcasts that have the resources to put out transcripts, it's really great. So.
Yeah. Yeah. And if you go to symposia.com/powertrip, there's like links to the transcripts, the Power Trip episodes, and then episodes of the Symposia kind of debrief podcast called Power Tripping, where the team just gets together and has kind of more high level drug nerd conversations about some of the things that have come up on Power Trip. So those are all options for people who are interested in this content and material. And if people have tips or information, you can email tips@symposia.com. If you have a story to tell or information you want us to have.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I'm really glad that this is a platform that you have with experiences that you've shared on there and your ability to investigate and report on this. The stories that are shared on that podcast series I'm really glad that they're getting that coverage. It's very important work. Lily, thank you so much for the time. I really appreciate it very much.
Thank you.
Hey, everybody. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Last Born in the Wilderness. If you would like to learn more about my work, you can go to my website, lastborninthewilderness.com. Everything you need to know will be there. If you would like to support my work, there are a few ways to do that. The first thing you can do, of course, is subscribe to this podcast. This podcast is on numerous platforms, so wherever you listen to podcasts, it should be there. So consider subscribing. And if you'd like to support this work monetarily, there are a few ways to do that. The first is through a one-time donation through PayPal and Venmo. Go to paypal.me/lastbornpodcast. Or you can find me on Venmo @lastbornpodcast. And if you would like to support my work on a regular basis, on a monthly or yearly basis, you can do that through Patreon. Go to patreon.com/lastborninthewilderness. And if you support my work there, you will gain early access to these interviews before I release them publicly. You will find other exclusive content there as well. So to everyone that is a supporter of my podcast, however you choose to do that, thank you very, very much. If you would like to leave an audio message that can be featured on the podcast, you can do that through two means. You can call the phone number 208-918-2837 and leave a message up to 3 minutes long. Please let me know what your intention is with the message so that I can then choose to feature it or not feature it on the podcast. If you would like to also just go to my website, lastbornthewilderness.com, you'll find a link at the top of the page that'll let you drop an audio file if that is preferable. And that is it, everybody. Thank you so much again for listening to this episode of Last Born in the Wilderness. Have a great week.